Alright, this is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Pete Lappin at Fort Walton Beach, Florida on the 24th of September, year 2000, at approximately 8:45 a.m. Alright, let's begin by a brief biographical sketch of yourself.
Alright, Steve, call me Pete.
Okay.
By the way. Born in 1940 in Boston, Massachusetts. Grew up and was raised in Lexington, a suburb outside of Boston. Graduated high school in 1958. Went to the University of Colorado. 58 to 62, 4 years of ROTC, pilot training in Valdosta, Georgia, survival at Stead, 2 years at MacDill Air Force Base, Tampa, Florida, to Vietnam in late 65. After a tour at Naha, Okinawa, we actually rotated from Naha to Udorn, Thailand. Thence, I went to Cameron Bay when they first opened Cameron Bay. Flew F-4s back to the States briefly at Davis-Monthan and Seymour Johnson, North Carolina, during the time that it was not fun to be in the military in the States. Decided to go back over, went to Ubon, Thailand. From Ubon, went to NKP to fly the O-2s, primarily to be the tasks 23rd TAS liaison to Task Force Alpha. Came back to the States in 69 and separated from the service.
Okay. Now, let's see, your time with the Tactical Fighter Squadron, 555th, 557th.
Triple Nickel and 557th,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You flew F-4s.
F-4s, mm-hmm.
What was that like? Compared to
we've all often wondered what descriptive phases you use to describe what it's like to fly a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in the year 2000 describing what was at the time the most advanced fighter in the world. Today it's an antique.
Mm-hmm.
But when people ask, I always tell them it was the greatest thing since, but not including sex, snow skiing, and gambling, and not necessarily in that order.
Okay. What was the transition like going from being in a fighter like the F-4 to the O-2?
It was horrendous. I couldn't land that little thing. I had a hellacious time learning to land the O-2,
mm-hmm.
But finally did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like anything else, once you catch on to it, it was pretty easy. But hard to believe, but the year of flying the O-2 out of NKP was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot more fun flying, because you're literally you are your own boss.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun.
Okay. Now, when you had flown F-4s earlier, let's see, you said you rotated in, helped open Cameron Bay with the first F-4s. Did you get to fly close air support missions at all with the F-4s in Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay.
They were, that was their primary mission.
Mm-hmm.
We had an occasional flight to North Vietnam for MidCap missions for the 105s,
mm-hmm.
But mostly it was close air support in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that was MidCap close air patrolling, or what is it?
The MidCap mission, mm-hmm. was separate from the close air support.
Okay.
MidCap, you fly to North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Refuel over the, mm-hmm. Gulf of Tonkin, and fly a 45-minute flight,
mm-hmm.
over North Vietnam, go back out to the tankers, refuel, and do it again.
Okay.
It was a long, long day, but, mm-hmm. what you did was you protected the airspace,
okay.
for the 105s, yes. who would come in and fly their missions.
Gotcha. So you basically, by MidCap, you're flying overhead, keeping, hopefully, acting as a deterrent to,
right.
MiGs from taking off.
Right.
Because if the MiGs get in the air, you guys are going to take them down.
That's right.
Okay. And then, as you said, you moved from there to
Cameron Bay.
That was at Cameron Bay.
I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah, and then from there you moved into Laos. Now, what time period was that? When did you actually arrive in Laos and become an O-2 pilot?
January 68.
Okay. Tet Offensive.
Right after the Tet. Matter of fact, the day the Tet Offensive hit was, mm-hmm. the day that I flew from Saigon to Bangkok, and it was 2 days later that I went to NKP.
Wow. What were your feelings about Tet? What did you think about that?
How
it blew open?
I was at Tantanoog when it actually hit. And the reason I knew we were in a lot of trouble, it was about 120 degrees on the ramp, and I saw an Air Force full colonel in his blues laying on the tarmac. And when the shells started to hit in and around Tantanoog, they eventually closed the airport. I got on one of the last flights to leave Tantanoog, and I had no idea where it was going. I just threw my bag on and jumped on, and it ended up going to Bangkok.
Okay.
It could have been going to Clark, it could have been going to Guam, who knows.
Right. Okay. And when you found yourself at NKP, what were things like there?
Oh, it was a... although I had been warned about what NKP was like when I was at UMON, it still was an awakening. Things were on a much, much smaller scale than they were at any of the other major bases in Thailand. It was all old, old airplanes, except for this new O2 that they were flying. Looked like you were back in World War II, or at least what my image of World War II was. But it was exciting because it was a different part of the war. And that was intriguing to me, and I was going to become part of it.
Okay. What was your evaluation of the O2 in terms of its... its structure, its the power supply, the twin engines?
Well, I didn't know anything else except the F-4.
Oh, okay.
And you had to have to understand that when you move from a high-performance fighter to a low-performance propeller-driven airplane, that it's quite a difference. But I didn't have any trouble with it. It was a fun airplane to fly, and the mission that we were flying gave it an excitement.
Okay.
So I, you know, was it the best airplane in the world? No, obviously not. It was an interim airplane, and we made the best use we could.
And by interim, you mean between the O1 and the OB10?
Yeah.
Which became the real workhorse.
Back airplane of choice. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and discuss your involvement with the SAR mission, Streetcar 304. And how did you become involved in that, under what circumstances, and how did events unfold once you became involved?
Okay. I was actually in Bangkok on a 3 or 4 day R&R, and as I was leaving the massage parlor, one of the facts who was coming in told me that they wanted me back at NKP as soon as possible, and that was the night of June 2nd. And I did get back to NKP that night late, and immediately went into a briefing where they talked about how Streetcar 304 had been shot down, and at that point they needed to get him out because they knew he was getting weak, they knew he was running out of resources. The weather was bad, we'd lost about 7 airplanes to the effort so far, that they were using him as a decoy, and there were 2 facts assigned. Myself and I believe it was Nail 51, but I'm not sure. And he was going to be my high fac. He would brief the fighters and then send them down to me. My job was to find Kenny Field and suppress the ground fire enough so that the Sandys and the Jollies could get in for a pickup. This was the third day, so we knew that his batteries would be getting weak. We knew that he would be getting weak. They also told me that they were authorizing the use of the special gas in case that we couldn't do anything else.
And this was the sleeping gas?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't remember what time we took off, but I remember getting to the area, and it was still dark. And the main first job was to find a way to get down through the clouds because they were pretty low. And even at that point, we didn't know if we were going to be able to put any suppression down. But as light started, first dawn started, I found a way to get under the clouds. We found a hole where the fighters could get down through. And however many flights we put in did a magnificent job. They were just incredible, being able to get down through the clouds and having an extremely short period of time to get oriented, mm-hmm. get lined up, drop their weapons, and get out. Until you've flown a fighter and know what that is, you just don't understand how the capabilities, how high a level of capability is required to do that. Mm-hmm. And I will forever take my hats off to those guys, because not only did they get down to the clouds, mm-hmm. not only did they find me and the target, they were able to get lined up and drop their weapons without putting them right on the survivor. Mm-hmm.
What was the minimum airspeed that they could, when they came down out of the clouds, and how much time did they have about, do you think?
You know, it would be pure guesstimate on my part at this stage, but I would say target recognition once you broke through the clouds, and that scenario was always changing, because mm-hmm. the clouds never stayed the same, never stayed in the same area. Mm-hmm. They were constantly moving. Mm-hmm. The ground threat was constantly changing. Mm-hmm. So to put specifics on it is mm-hmm. hard, but I would say from breakout to target acquisition to bomb release could be no more than 10 seconds,
wow.
and maybe less than that.
Wow. And how fast were they going, usually, when they broke out of the clouds? 350
to 450.
Wow.
And in some cases, faster.
That's moving.
Oh, yeah. Well, they didn't want to expose themselves any longer than necessary either.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, when they came down, the first thing that they would see would be my smoke, and then me, and then they would see shells being fired.
Mm-hmm.
But they did wonderful. And I would estimate that there were a minimum. While I was not on station, but my total time was about 5 hours. I would probably say a good hour and a half to 2 hours was spent putting in fighters. There would be breaks in the action when obviously we couldn't get them down. Reacquire the target, because there were times where I would end up going up in the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
But my altitude was probably anywhere from 2,500 to 3,500 feet. They didn't shoot me down. And I was able to talk to Kenny, find out where he was. He would tell me where the last vestiges of firepower were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we put the targets in.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could see them fire.
Okay.
At one point in time, he told me where some firing was from, and it was from people in trees real close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, you have to get those guys, because for the Jolly Greens to come in, mm-hmm. these guys are going to shoot them down. So we put some CBUs in, and this is the interesting story that he will elaborate on. When they got him back to the hospital at NKP, he expressed to the nurse, who I guess was a male nurse, that he had some pain in his groin area. And apparently they unrolled the foreskin and a CBU pellet fell out.
Oh, goodness.
He tells that story much better than I can. But
nice.
That was the weapon that we put in to get rid of the last guns that seemed to be a threat to the Jolly Greens, although we'll never know if we got them all.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point in time, Kenny came up on the radio and said, "I'm hit." And I called him, Sandys, and I said, "Get in here, let's get him out."
Mm-hmm.
And they did. I left and I went back to NKP.
Mm-hmm.
And I climbed on an airplane and went back to Bangkok.
Okay. Finish your R&R.
Yep.
Wow. Were there in.
I came back and there was never a hole in the airplane.
I was just going to say, did you ever get hit by anything? Nothing.
That morning, nothing.
Wow. What about other aircraft? Nobody else got shot down that day?
Nobody else got shot down.
Okay. And how did you isolate Kenny in terms of his location? Was it identifying you as where you were flying over? Or, you know, how was that accomplished?
Okay, well, he was able to see me.
Mm-hmm.
he saw and identified me. And I said, now I've got to identify you.
Mm-hmm.
And he described his location, and it was pretty succinct. I mean, there was an open field, and there were a clump of trees in the middle of the open field, and that's where he was.
Oh, okay.
The clump of trees, I don't mean to give it the... It's a large clump,
mm-hmm.
and it was necessary to get him pinpointed in that clump of trees.
Mm-hmm.
So when he said he was hit, we had him pop smoke, and
okay.
he still had a smoke flare,
okay.
and we had positively identified him. The Jollies and the Sandies were holding to the southwest on the other side of the ridgeline,
mm-hmm.
and when I talked to, and I can't remember who I talked directly to, but I think it was Crown, and I think Crown was the one that cleared them in. And they did get ground fire, mm-hmm. a helicopter was shot at when they picked him up.
What kind of weapon systems? Small arms?
I think it was small arms.
Okay.
I think we'd gotten just about every one of the big things, but okay. when you're a helicopter, it doesn't take much.
No. It takes an AK-47.
That's right. Yeah. So, that was my involvement, and it was the Jolly Greens hold a reunion,
mm-hmm.
and it was here at Fort Walton Beach mm-hmm. that Kenny and I and a couple of the Sandies first got together for the first time since that mission.
Wow.
This is one of the things about the mission in Southeast Asia. It happened today. Tomorrow you were right back as if yesterday had never happened.
Mm-hmm. Was there any indication while you were on station that the NVA were listening to your radio transmissions, you know, maybe particular movements that they engaged in, or when, for instance, Kenny popped his smoke, did other people pop smoke in the area, things like that?
No.
Okay.
As John told you earlier, it was felt like this whole area was, besides being a transitional route for transportation south,
mm-hmm.
it was also kind of a rest and relaxation area for the guys at Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of numbers, nobody knows how many people were there, but that whole area was just saturated with NVA troops and Laotian helpers.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of numbers, and in terms of being smart enough to do that, mm-hmm. listen to the radio, interpret what we're saying, and pop a false smoke note.
Okay. I heard that had happened in other areas, which is why I asked.
Yeah, yeah. May have. I never saw it.
Okay. And how about in your discussions later with Ed Leonard?
Is that Ed Leonard.
The Sandy that was shot down. Did he have? Has he given you any indication of the disposition or the size of the enemy force that
yes.
you guys were going against? Because
yep.
he was captured. And,
yep.
you know, so he saw firsthand the enemy.
He would make a fascinating interview for you.
Yes.
And he would be more than happy to do it.
Okay.
That kind of information, you know, again, it becomes third hand for
right.
me, and I
right.
I would certainly defer to his.
Okay, excellent. And I would definitely interview him. Well, how did your participation in the SAR mission affect you as a pilot and as a person? You know, this is a pretty highly stressful situation, highly emotional, and, you know, you pulled it off.
You know, at the time, you have to, and I would caution the reader to remember, the listener to remember that I was 27.
Mm-hmm.
27, come out of fighters, you're invincible.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, nothing can go wrong. And I'm sure that was the attitude that I portrayed most of the time.
Okay.
Once it's over, you simply move on. You mm-hmm. do not realize at that time the implication. Help to save a guy's life. Well, maybe that's what it's all about, but you moved on.
Mm-hmm.
As you get older, the import begins to really take effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably in Kenny's case, and certainly in John Mercury's case, age has made this one of the highlights of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's why we put so much importance on it today.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to stopping a truck
as opposed to the political philosophy that they never did get out there with troops and cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail down, which the North Vietnamese have said time and time again, we'll just stop the war.
Mm-hmm.
Our politicians were never smart enough to do that, or didn't want to,
mm-hmm.
or were afraid to. Who knows? Depends on who you believe, I guess. But in hindsight, you can see all of these things. But that's when saving a life becomes takes on a much higher significance.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize what the importance was when I did it. I was more anxious to get back to Bangkok.
Mm-hmm. Okay, to the massage parlor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think probably I've made a lot more of that than really it was to.
It sounds good today.
It's a great story. Well, I'm curious, did you ever have any other occasions to use that special gas that you mentioned in missions?
No, never
the
used
only
it.
Time.
Never used it.
Okay. And why don't we go ahead and take a few minutes and talk about Task Force Alpha and your position there as the liaison between Task Force Alpha and the IBM. I guess explain that.
Okay,
please.
TFA, or Task Force Alpha,
mm-hmm.
was charged with the Igloo White mission. The Igloo White mission was McNamara's electronic wall.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was dropping sensors from, among other airplanes, the F-4, hopefully in a small enough, specific enough area that when the listening post at Task Force Alpha, which was a building on in the corner of NKP, could listen to these sensors talk. And they were actually microphones that were listening, and you could listen to them back there. And if you heard trucks moving or people talking, and interpreters could listen to what they were saying, and hopefully you could find out where truck parks were, fuel depots, or troop movements. And you could target fighters then appropriately. Since I had flown F-4s, and the F-4s were the primary droppers of the sensors,
mm-hmm.
I was able to go back to U-Bahn and brief the F-4s and work with the IBM guys at Task Force Alpha in putting these sensors in.
Mm-hmm.
We found out through listening that the North Vietnamese valued these sensors highly because of the parachutes. They could use the parachutes for hammocks or sleeping bags or ground covers or whatever. They just threw the rest of it, including the microphones, away, but they wanted the parachutes. And so there's a little humor.
Mm-hmm.
I've often wondered what it would be like to talk to somebody who had actually grabbed one of these sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned earlier that there was actually some conflict between IBM and the military component. A schism, I think is what you call it.
Yeah.
Would you describe that or talk about that issue?
You know, I'm not really sure what I mean when I say that. The only remembrance I really have is that if Task Force Alpha, through the sensors, found a truck park,
mm-hmm.
to get that truck park targeted fast enough to do some good,
mm-hmm.
didn't seem to work.
Okay.
And so the schism that I referred to was really a reference to the fact that by the time something could happen that could materially be good, truck park probably moved, because they knew this was a moving, this Ho Chi Minh Trail was a living, breathing orgasm, if you will. It was constantly moving and changing, and to be able to make it work, you had to have somebody listening to the sensor talking, saying we've got trucks moving at this sector or at these coordinates, and have somebody from there call a FAC who had facilities or who had assets available to him,
mm-hmm.
and put it right in, and that didn't work.
Well, what was the process of getting information from the sensors to the military commanders so that they could launch some form of an attack?
Whatever it was, it took too long.
Oh, okay. So okay.
And that was frustrating from my standpoint.
Right.
What of the process that I described that was necessary
mm-hmm.
wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
There were too many levels of command that had to be gone through before you could get. There were very few times that there were fighters with ordnance
mm-hmm.
available for targets of opportunity.
Okay.
Usually, and those were the kind of assets that you would have that mm-hmm. could meet this requirement.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't available, and usually when they were coming back from another target that was weathered in, and they simply were targeted to orbit for targets of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And no fighter ever wanted to come back to the base without having his ordnance dispensed.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of FACs who put targets of opportunity available to these guys was probably a lot more than we will ever know.
Mm-hmm.
And those targets of opportunity were a continuation of something that might have been there 5 days ago.
Okay.
Wasted.
And the receiving station itself is actually run by civilian IBM personnel.
Yes.
With their own interpreters.
Yes.
And it was something that if perhaps military intelligence personnel had been involved with a direct link to you, the FAC, or to air mm-hmm. assets that might have been in the area, then maybe a better system could have evolved. But
there's no question a better system could have been put into place. I do believe there were military intelligence people involved.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, I could be briefed by our intelligence people at the 23rd TASS who would tell me, without knowing what my job was, 2 days earlier we had reports from Task Force Alpha that there were trucks in this area.
Well, why are you being told 2 days later?
I think it broke the code.
Wow.
It happened a lot.
Wow. That must have been very frustrating.
It was. It was, and, you know, and that was part of the problem that the guys had over there as they matured and grew older,
mm-hmm.
And for the first time, reports from the states showed that in the middle 60s and
mm-hmm.
66, 67, campus riots and laying down in front of troop trains. When I went back to the states, it was no fun. That's part of the reason I went back overseas.
Mm.
But then you started to question, and more people started to question, the military political decisions that were being made.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, those who chose to read McNamara's book probably got sick in the process, as I did.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, you still had the mission to do, and then while you can always see better ways to do it, you still did it. Okay. Babbling.
Not at all. Did you ever have opportunity to talk with the IBM civilian personnel that work at NKP?
Oh yeah, on a regular basis.
And how was your relationship with them, and how did they interact generally with the Air Force personnel that were on base, especially in that chain that was supposed to exist so that the transmission of information would occur?
The head of the IBM project, and I wish I could remember his name, he was an All-American football player at Michigan,
okay.
had two PhDs. He was quite a person.
Mm-hmm.
He and I had a great relationship. Step out of that personal relationship into the professional one, and I think he was probably as frustrated as I was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say that between the military and between IBM, there was kind of a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you had a brigadier general
mm-hmm.
sitting there, and you had some full colonels and light colonels, to get something done seemed to have a block at mm-hmm. 7th Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
That,
so you would identify the block in the terms of the flow of information in the Air Force, not necessarily in IBM, or vice versa? No. Or in, right in the middle?
I have to believe it was right in the middle. Remember, the unlike running a business, military had tours of duty. And who might be your friend at a control desk today, rotated out tomorrow.
Right.
And some new guy came in who had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he had an idea, usually had his own way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened not in one place, but in several up the line. So while we had our own choke points.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings up an interesting question, an issue about the war. The rotation system. What did you think about that? As a pilot, you know, my understanding, based on my conversations with other men this weekend, it usually took between 3 and 6 months to really get used to being a FAC. And so, if in a year tour, then you spend another maybe 6 months or 9 months, and then you're gone. And some other guy's going to come in, and he's got the learning curve. So we're repeating the experience over and over again of learning, being effective, and then splitting. What did you think of that as a policy?
I thought it was a waste of essence,
mm-hmm.
waste of experience. There is no question that the Vietnam War was conducted in a much different fashion than anything previous. Probably it was a learning experience for everybody who conducted it, and hindsight is wonderful. I think we had a tremendous waste of talent. But I also think it was not necessary to waste that talent because of the political decisions. Correct political decisions, totally different result. But as long as your assessment is correct, that should we send somebody over there for 6 months for productivity?
Yeah. So was this talked about much? In the Air Force circles that where you were running, in terms of, you know, why are we conducting the war in this fashion? Was it a topic of conversation then, or was it is this exclusively?
No, it
hindsight?
Was a topic of conversation then.
Okay.
But not to the level that it was afterwards.
Okay.
Almost in passing,
mm-hmm.
because you're still talking about a group of professionals that are going to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take a group, you're going to have a group that are going to say, okay, my year of tour is up January 1st. If I stay at 5,500 feet or 6,000 feet, my chances of making it to January 1st are a whole lot better
mm-hmm.
than if I go down to 4,000 feet or 3,500 feet.
Right.
So there's a level of quality for doing a job,
mm-hmm.
as there was with every fighter pilot group.
Right.
Press the target to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt fortunate that I worked most of the time with guys who were very, very professional.
Mm-hmm.
The taxpayers got their money's worth
mm-hmm.
in terms of doing the political job that mm-hmm. was required.
But would you say that, but based on what you just said, it seems like at a certain point when you're getting close to your DROS,
mm-hmm.
the issue becomes survivability versus the mission or winning. Was that the case at all?
Unfortunately, yeah. Because statistics bore out the fact that so many guys in their last week got shot down. There was a tremendous amount of weight put on that last week
mm-hmm.
And the last day,
mm-hmm.
Last mission. Who knows what caused it? But guys, as the statistics came in, that your chances of being shot down in the last week of your tour over here, or you're on your last mission, as that word filters around, survivability becomes paramount. Because you know, if you know that this coming Tuesday you're going home, are you going to want to go out and fly a Route PAC 6 mission tomorrow? Not doubtful. Or if you do, where are you going to stay? I'm having trouble getting gas. You know, no, there's no question about that. And I think that was part and parcel of the sociological psychic
mm-hmm.
that made us up in the middle 60s.
Mm-hmm. And while we're on the topic of some of the broader issues of the war and the strategies employed, what did you and other Air Force pilots that you talked with, and other personnel, some of the maybe civilians, IBM civilians, what did you think about the conduct of the war in terms of Westmoreland's attrition policy, the body count, you know, how we were measuring victory was basically by seeing if we couldn't attrit the Vietnamese forces faster than they attrited ours. Did you think that was a viable strategy?
I can tie several things into that answer, starting with the restrictions we had as fighter pilots flying over North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Started with a 25-mile bare boundary with the Chinese border that we couldn't penetrate. Mm-hmm. It progressed to circles of diameter, circles of a safe area around the airfields where the MiGs were first kept when they came down from China to Kep and Phuken. We could see the MiGs on the end of the runway waiting to take off after we dropped our bombs and got light on fuel. We couldn't hit them. To the ships of friendly countries, quote-unquote friendly, that were in Haiphong Harbor waiting to unload that we couldn't hit. To the fact that the military puts such a priority on body count and rolling stock count. And it was early in the war that we had killed the entire rolling stock of North Vietnamese at least twice. So you kind of took all of that with a grain of salt. You talked about politicians in kind of a laughing manner. And I think much like as we grow older, certain events become more important. I think also the retrospective looks that we take at things are much different today than they were back then. I'm not sure we had the maturity as individuals to look at what was happening in the big picture.
Okay.
You could isolate on some of the individual things and say, ha ha, boy, are they screwed up. But I don't think it's the big picture we had it at that point. But it became clearer and clearer as time went by. And did we respect it? No. You know, it's interesting that Clinton's going back to Vietnam soon when it won't have any effect because he's a lame duck president. And he's the first president to go back there since Nixon. And then Nixon only went to Cam Ranh Bay, which at that point was a very safe vintage. Interesting. You know, when I'm on a Babylon, I think the Vietnam War is going to be marked by historians as the sea event of certainly the 20th century. It may also be the event that turns our society into something that we don't fully recognize today. We didn't have before that the freedom of the borders that we have today. There were restrictions on immigrants. Today there are almost none. The different groups that have come out of the closet, the freedoms that we don't have today that we had before that, the government regulation that in some good, some bad, but becoming more so. I think history is going to show that the Vietnamese conflict changed society in an irreversible way. And we don't know where that's leading us yet. I think that's what Vietnam is going to prove to be.
What lessons do you think we should take away from the Vietnam War as a nation?
Oh, Lord.
Well, what major lesson in your estimation?
Don't underestimate the Oriental mind. And I would think probably people who debriefed Korea have said the same thing. Do we have to learn our lessons all over again? Yeah. Our human nature and our egos demand that we learn lessons all over again. We can't take what other people have learned.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and stop here? So we'll end the first interview with Pete Lappin.